welcome back everybody to Leaf Promotions, the Unsigned Podcast. This week I'll be talking to acoustic instrumentalist George Fell about all things unsigned. Most of you will have noticed by now, but it's been quite a gap since our last episode, and thankfully that's only for positive reasons. We now have more regular nights in Stockport, Manchester and Liverpool, and we've just been really, really busy with that. So unfortunately, haven't had time to edit many episodes, but we're back, so you can check those out on our social media, at Leaf Promotions on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. Wherever you're listening to this podcast, we'd really appreciate it if you'd like and subscribe. Apologies in advance, folks, if the sound quality isn't as good as usual. We actually recorded this in the summer of 2021, and George was sat in a field outside of Metalworks, so we do have a few sound issues. Hopefully I sorted them all out. So without further ado, here's George Fell. Enjoy. Welcome back, everybody. My next guest has been a regular at our Sat Tap Acoustic Showcase for a few years now. And I say with no exaggeration that I believe he is, in my opinion, the greatest guitar player I've ever seen live. And I know a lot of our gig regulars would agree with me. It's George Fell. How you doing, mate?
Good afternoon, John. Yeah, I can't really complain. I'm sitting in the Yorkshire sun right now, so it could be worse.
Yeah, you're currently sat in a builder's yard, aren't you? So there could be some crazy noises in the background.
Where I spend a lot of my time.
Yeah, a lot of people might not know that you're also a professional sculptor as well as an instrumental artist.
Yeah, I spend many hours on metalwork, welding, doing quite strenuous physical labour.
That's quite a departure from the world of unsigned music.
Yeah, it's an interesting task to juggle both things, but I strive to maintain both endeavours.
So I'll start off with this. One of my biggest regrets in Leaf history is not getting you down to a Leaf gig sooner. As I know you said before that it was the longest wait to play for a promoter that you'd ever had.
Yeah. You arrived in my inbox like mysteriously. I think it was like 18 months after I'd reached out to you, which I thought it was magnificent that you'd even kind of backtracked it that far. But here we are.
We do have like an extensive waiting list, but it's not normally that long. And I feel bad that I didn't get back to sooner. It's just to get a huge volume.
It gave you a certain mystique by arriving that late. So
were you more intrigued in the gigs with the wait time?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. You know, it's good to have an air of mystery.
So I first met you through someone else, through Claire Northey, who is a violinist and singer from France.
Yeah, she's lovely. I was in a group with her. We did a live project with DJ Yoda where we went on tour doing like live hip-hop, which was amazing. So that's how we became friends, really. But yeah, she was a joy to work with. I've recorded some tracks with her as well, and yeah, she's phenomenal.
Yeah, I first met her in the band Sip Smith and Twine, if you ever saw them.
Oh yeah,
they used to play some acoustic events for me. He came down with Claire, but we weren't really properly introduced at that stage, and like you say, it was a long time before you actually came to play a gig. The first time you ever played for me was in the Petersgate Tap in Stockport, which is a night that's still going and getting better and better all the time, and you become somewhat of a regular there.
Yeah, absolutely.
People are generally making a huge effort to come out and see you every time you play now.
It's a lovely environment. It's an environment I thrive in, like that kind of small room upstairs where I can really fill the space, because, you know, doing guitar instrumentals, if you get people in a small space like that, you can really kind of mesmerise them, because you're up close, you're right in the vicinity, so they get a lot more caught up in what you're doing.
It is a relatively small venue, but yeah, like you say, I think it helps out with the instrumental stuff because it is so much more of an intimate space. People can get really up close to it. And like I say, you developed a really good following off the back of that in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think instrumental music is very underrated in environments that could be quite, you know, noisy. In a pub setting, the people are still kind of able to talk to a certain extent without it intruding in the music, because when there's vocals, people's voices start clashing with the vocals. But because that, with me, there's no real voice to compete with, like I can have people sort of murmuring in the background and it still doesn't really take away from the music.
Yeah, I mean, ideally every single crowd would be sat there silently watching you, but obviously some gigs just wouldn't like that. And instrumental music can be a bit of a victim of that scene.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, yeah, I've kind of developed my style from playing in quite rowdy environments, trying to find a way of still working with the ambience of the room, but still kind of cutting through the background noise, you know. A lot of the music I listen to is instrumental, and a lot of that would have been played in quite raucous environments, you know. And I think certain kind of genres, certain ways of with going about music, it doesn't really matter whether there's some background noise to compete with. It still kind of shines through it.
Historically, when you played, like, the Petersgate Tap is a venue where the crowd is really attentive anyway, but you have done other festivals and stuff for me where the crowd isn't necessarily just there for the music, so they're not necessarily just entirely focused on the stage. But I think in the past, you've treated as that as a challenge rather than being annoyed by it to try and win that crowd over.
Yeah. I think I'm one of the few kind of acoustic acts where I'll encourage people to talk as opposed to being annoyed by it, you know. I do. It's obviously lovely if you have a sort of captive, silent audience, but then I like the reassurance that everybody's kind of having fun as well, you know. So if people do want to, are in the middle of a conversation, I don't necessarily want to just cut it out straight away. I like those moments where you can feel that everyone's locked into what you're doing all of a sudden, and that, you know, like, where there'll be moments where you can feel the room going silent from there being a bit of a murmur, and there'll be a moment where it's all gone silent and you're like, I'm got everyone's attention now.
I think you are definitely one of those people who can do that, and I've seen rooms where there was kind of no interest in what's going on the stage, completely won round by what you're doing on there, and like 20 minutes into the set, everyone shut up and they're all in awe.
Yeah, well, that's lovely. That's very reassuring.
It's a sound of a quality act, so keep doing what you're doing. So you've alluded to the fact that you are obviously an instrumental guitarist, but how would you describe your actual style of music?
This is difficult, really. I think it kind of sits somewhere between bluegrass and jazz and blues, I suppose, but it also has elements of electronic music. I'm really interested in electronic music and the kind of compositional aspect of that. I like the kind of the rhythmic pulse of it, really. I like music that kind of drives itself along and is kind of mesmeric. So yeah, I think it's always difficult to try and sum it up, but yeah, it's really just kind of melodic instrumental music. I don't know if I would pigeonhole it into a genre, but I mean, the techniques I use on guitar are definitely borrowed from bluegrass, early blues, and some elements of like Spanish guitar music as well. I try and use those techniques to then play stuff that you wouldn't necessarily expect to hear on a guitar, and especially on a solo guitar.
You've reinterpreted dance tracks before, you've played like Colombian dance music, you've done quite folky stuff. I know you've done some commissions for various companies, like you did a song commissioned by Metrolink, if I'm remembering right.
It was commissioned by the Bridgewater Hall in honour as a kind of commemorative thing to the Metrolink service,
I think that summarises just how random your set can actually be.
I thrive with that kind of a brief, because you know, music's a very it's very intangible, and that's especially with instrumental music. I think if you've got a song, it's got a subject matter usually, because the words draw you towards certain images and certain stories, whereas an instrumental tune, if it's good, it could kind of mean anything. It should be both melancholy and joyous at the same time, really. That's kind of what I strive for. I read a phrase once, it was like downcast euphoria. that's what I'm striving for. It's like both joyous and depressing at the same time.
I think that definitely comes across. I suppose that is the advantage of instrumental music. It's open to a wider interpretation, really. When you've got vocals, you're kind of describing what you originally meant the song to be about. But when it's just when it's just notes played in a certain order, you can read it in your own way.
Yeah, and I think as a performer, that's good as well, because, you know, I think a lot of the time, if the singer's in a bad mood and then they've got to sing something that's about a happy subject, that's the challenge. But you know, I can adapt my performance to whatever mood I'm in that day, and I could play the same tune in two completely different frames of mind, but it would still resonate with me on that day, because I can kind of interpret it how I want.
So are there any influences in terms of directly from instrumental guitarists that you would say have influenced you?
My love of playing and stuff came from, I was really into early country blues recordings when I was a teenager. So there was guitarists like Lead Belly, Reverend Gary Davis, they're all quite obscure, Skip James, Booker White, people like that. They've made recordings in like the late 1920s, 1930s that I was quite obsessed with them when I was a kid. So I sort of collected CDs of their stuff, and a lot of the recordings are really scratchy, like they sound like they were recorded in a little tin box, you know. I was so interested in it. I got a book that described all the guitar methods, and I just kind of obsessively studied how to play their music. Then gradually I realized those techniques, they all play in like a polyphonic way. So, you know, there's a bass line and there's a melody at the same time. So then once I'd sort of got those techniques down, it meant I was like, I could open up doors of exploring new places to take those techniques, because it's quite liberating, really. If you can play several parts at once, you can kind of create a whole musical atmosphere, a whole kind of little miniature world with just a guitar. Following from that, you know, I was really into people like Jimi Hendrix and stuff as well when I was a teenager. So I also kind of studied how their technique worked. And in the end, I kind of was sort of using those solo runs from all kinds of that kind of psychedelic era, and then doing that at the same time as doing the bass line. And yeah, it just opens up a whole world of possibilities.
It's funny that you mentioned the ability to play like maybe bass and guitar at the same time, because there are two things that always get mentioned when you play Leaf gigs. First thing is, loads of people say, oh, it sounds like he's playing more than one guitar at once. I don't know how he's doing it.
Yeah,
trying to understand how you get your fingers to work in that way.
Well, yeah, I mean, playing 12-string is useful for that as well. Like, I mainly perform with a 12-string, which does sound quite orchestral if you're playing several melodies at once, because the amount of strings you're hitting is just... gives you an advantage straight away.
I think it just makes it look even more impressive as well when you're able to command the 12-string like on stage with nothing else other than just you playing it. No backing, no drums, no vocals.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the only thing to perform with, but I do find that it feels like it's strong armour almost against an audience, because you've just got this like enormous capacity to make a lot of noise if you need to. Because it's just a big thing. It's a big tool to use.
Well, the second thing that always gets mentioned, and this is a bit of a strange one, is your unorthodox stage banter. I'm going to put it that way.
Yeah. I think it's never an intentional thing, really. It's just the kind of stream of consciousness. For one, I've been performing for quite a long time, so that kind of awkwardness isn't really there anymore. So I will just kind of say the first thing that comes to my head. But also, I think it's kind of, it's disarming for an audience as well. I think it's about letting them know that you're comfortable, and then they feel more comfortable. Because I think if you're watching someone and they're clearly quite nervous and a bit awkward, that tension sort of leaks out to the people who are watching you, and then they start to feel tense. So you've got to kind of set the tone of this is a friendly space.
Yeah, definitely. Your style definitely relaxes the crowd. Like, the one comment I get more than anything is always the first time they see you, they go, is this guy drunk because he had a few beers? But most of the time, you're not even drinking at the gigs when he comes out.
Well, yeah. I think, I remember I watched, my parents took me to see John Martin, you know, John Martin, like this legendary kind of psychedelic folk singer, and they took me to see him when I was like 11. I remember watching him, and he was in his later stages of life then. He was pretty obese and he had one leg, so he got wheeled out on a wheelchair with one leg, but he was amazing. Like, you know, it was pitch perfect the whole gig. It was perfect, but in between songs he would just talk this complete incoherent babble. But like nobody understood what he was saying, but everybody was hanging on his every word. And I was watching him, I was like, oh, that really works. Like,
oh, that's how you did it. Yeah,
that's the way to do it.
You carried it onto your own stage presence in that way.
Yeah.
How did you get into original music? I mean, you said your parents took you down to that concert. Were your parents in bands themselves? Did they push you to play original stuff?
No, I mean, my dad was interested in guitars, and so he had guitars around the house. I mean, he could play a little bit. He taught me some like rudimentary chords when I was like, I don't know, 10, 11 or something. But I just found it, I think when I was a teenager, I just found it quite therapeutic. I was really interested in those early blues styles of guitar. So I like just obsessively learned all those people's tunes. Gradually, it just kind of became like a sort of a therapeutic thing, really. I was very private with it. I wouldn't... wouldn't even tell my friends that I played guitar until well into a few years that I was doing it. I suppose once I'd run out of tunes to learn, I just started making them up myself because I loved the act of sort of sitting on my own in my own world, being creative. So it was a way of keeping my overactive mind busy, really.
I mean, it must have been amazing for your friends when they didn't know you played guitar and then suddenly you're coming out with all these like immense, like, three-part guitar pieces.
Yeah, I was a bit eccentric anyway, so they just thought that was another sort of not smart.
No surprise to them.
But yeah, I mean, the music I was interested in wasn't particularly cool, you know. I was learning ragtime and things like that. I was also into like gangster rap and stuff as well, because that was the music of the time when in like the early 2000s. But I kind of had this sort of double life, really. It was definitely like an important thing for me to do. I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have that when I was growing up, really.
I think it's always the more unusual path, people who learn guitar without the eventual intention of going out and showing it to people. You obviously took it up just because you had an interest in it originally, and then you felt like you were going to go out and perform in front of people.
Yeah, I think I was quite reluctant to perform at first. My parents sent me for lessons with a guy called Sam Lees, who's quite a good guitarist, when I was a teenager. But they sent me because they wanted me to learn, like, you know, notation and sight reading and stuff, because that would potentially get me into like a music school. But I didn't really take to that because if you're not playing like classical music, and a lot of the music I played was like quite syncopated and stuff. In order to play something even quite simple, to write something quite simple, you have to do all these mad rests and stuff. So I didn't fall into it that well. But he arranged for me to go and play at a local pub in Glossop. I grew up in Glossop. He'd already booked me onto it before I could say anything about it. So I was just like, well, this is happening. But I mean, it was really, I thought, well, at least this will justify how much time I've spent practicing. I was just kind of doing it with no intention of what I was going to do with it as a result, you know. Even now, I mean, I think the most important thing for me is to just have it as a therapeutic thing. My need to perform only comes from the idea that, like, if I'm not performing, then I don't really know what I've been spending all my time doing this for.
Yeah, it got to a point where it wasn't just for your own enjoyment. You thought, yeah, I need to justify it by going out and performing in front of people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
How did it feel the first time you ever went out and played your stuff in front of a crowd?
Not great, pretty nerve-wracking. I think it took me a few years to actually start enjoying it. I had a fair little like local circuit in Glossop. Like I perform quite regularly around there, but when you've not got the experience, things go wrong. Like you're not prepared for the first time you like go out of tune, or like sometimes your hands will be shaking because you'll get full of adrenaline as soon as everyone starts looking at you. It takes everything that could possibly go wrong to go wrong before you stop being afraid of it anymore, you know? So you've got to go through a lot of embarrassment before you become any less nervous.
I think I feel exactly the same about doing gigs. I still got nervous before gigs now, but I was a lot worse when I first started doing it years ago, because I always thought the worst things would happen. But then we literally had floods, fires, bands not turning up, bands being late, like major technical problems. Exactly. We've had everything. Exactly. You just get used to it.
Yeah, and you're just like, now I fear nothing. But yeah, I mean, it's weird though, it can still creep up on you. Like you can go and play in front of like thousands of people and it won't really feel like anything, but then you can be in a really small room in front of like 20 people and you'll freeze up for a second. I've still not really found the formula, and I don't think there is one. You don't know when the sort of fear is going to set in, but you've just got to do it anyway.
I think some of the other people on this podcast so far have mentioned that it is kind of more nerve-wracking playing smaller crowds, and they've done big festivals, because it's as intimate as it can get. They're right up close to you. They're literally face-to-face with you sometimes. To be able to perform to a crowd who's there for that reason, it can be pretty intimate.
But, I mean, it's that thing as well. If you're on a massive stage, there's literally like a massive physical gap between you and the audience. Like, I remember the first time I was sort of playing on big festival stages, you barely even notice the crowd there, because there's like, there's that huge ditch where all the security are, and then there's the barriers, and then the crowd are all there, and there's kind of so many of them, they just look like a sea of people. They don't really look like people.
So yeah, you can't even pick out people's faces, so it bothers you less.
It does. It's nothing. Like, before you do it, you think it's going to be terrifying, and then when you do it, you're like, oh, is that all it was?
So in all the years you've been doing gigs, what in your opinion is the best thing about being part of the Unsigned scene?
Well, I suppose it's always quite magical when you see somebody who blows you away and that you had no knowledge of them before. And it's kind of like you become aware of sort of vast scope of talent that there is amongst just the human race in general. And it's quite reassuring. You know, it's not like, because I think you've got no expectations with unsigned artists. So when they blow you away, it's quite magical. Whereas, you know, if you already love something, if you go and see an artist you're already familiar with, you know all their work, like, if anything, you're going to be disappointed if it doesn't live up to your expectations. If someone surpasses your expectations, that's always better. And that's what you have in a kind of unsigned environment, because everybody's just doing their thing and there's not really any hype around it. So it's a lot more magical when it gets you.
I feel the same about covers gigs. They can only ever be almost as good as the original at best.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with covers, I love a good cover in terms of, like, as long as it's taking the song to a different place. I think if it's a tribute band, then I agree with you. But I think, like, a very inventive cover where it's been taken and reinterpreted as something completely different, I think I really enjoy those. It's the task I often set myself to try and find new tunes that I can set to guitar that people wouldn't expect, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you in terms of, yeah, if you completely kind of rearranged a cover, like, to suit your style, then absolutely. But I just don't think enough covers bands are going out and doing that. I think we've had that conversation enough times on this podcast now.
Yeah, totally.
What, in your opinion, is the worst thing about being involved in the unsigned scene?
Well, I suppose it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? I suppose you can end up doing some quite depressing things. But I mean, that can happen in the signed scene as well. But if you go and do something that isn't particularly well paid, and then no one's really listening, and it was just a really bad bit of billing, you know, like where someone's booked you for something and it really wasn't the right thing, wasn't the right place for you. And sometimes you can arrive somewhere and it'll suddenly strike you that this this was a big mistake.
The minute you walk in the door, you realise that this isn't
right. Yeah, well, just that you weren't right for that night, you know? And then, but then you've still got to kind of go through with it, and then you'll be kind of on your way back and you've probably just broken even with the money you've been given for the gig. So it's just like, that was just a waste of everyone's time.
Well, that is normally one of the things that people say is the worst thing about the unsigned scene, is kind of, you're never going to make any money out of it for a long period of time.
Oh, yeah, totally. I've tried to find places where my music fits the bill in terms of, like, I can fit quite well as, like, background music, like a piano player in a hotel or something like that. I do a lot of gigs where they are just strange events, played in an army rehabilitation centre before. I played at, like, shop openings, like furniture shop openings, things like that. Those things, they tend to be better paid and there's not as much attention on you, so that then it's all right. But you've got to be not too picky about what you're doing. I think if there's an environment where your music works, even if that's not what you expected it to be used for, then you've just got to do it, especially if there's money involved, because it's, you know, it's better that it's being heard than not being heard.
Someone has seen your set a number of times. I think it's a bit of a travesty to put you down as background music, but I suppose you're getting paid.
I'm quite happy to be background music, really. I'm still having fun.
Yeah, main thing, man.
Yeah, I think it's that thing. It's like, the only thing you're in control of is what you're doing. How people would interpret it is up to them. So if it's not being received the way you want it to, then that might not be the right environment for it, you know? Like, wherever it's, you can play it and it's appreciated, you should just go and do that.
I think you're right. You basically have no control over the opinion of people who are in the audience. So it's mainly about putting yourself in a place where you're likely to get the right audience.
Like we were saying before, you've not really got any control over how they behave either. If people are talking, I would rather try and, like, roll with that than try and get them to show up, try and get it to weave into their evening in a pleasing way for them. It's supposed to be listened to and being enjoyed. Like, that's the point of it.
Well, there's two ways of going at it. You can either, try and back yourself and win over a crowd that isn't very attentive. Or you can go the other way and just shout at them until they're quiet and then hope that they don't like your set, which a lot of people do. Yeah. I know Matt Fries enjoys telling people to be quiet, and he'll say as much.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if that feels right, then do that. But I've always liked to try and, you know, find some harmony with the audience.
But I think that has definitely worked for you in the past. I've seen many a more, I was going to say wild audience. It's not quite a wild audience. A chatty audience, that kind of silence within the first couple of songs of your set. So you must be doing something right.
Well, I mean, I was really into, like I said, like electronic music. I really like going to like more kind of ravey environments when I was younger. So I like, that's the thing with those places. Again, it's like a lot of that music's instrumental and it's not demanding the spotlight. It's just going on in the background. It's just kind of chugging away in the background while people are having their night. And I kind of like the idea that I can kind of do that on my own acoustically, you know. It's just providing like an exciting ambiance to people as opposed to demanding their full attention. But then, I don't know, sometimes inadvertently they do just end up watching.
And all the time you've been gigging, is the one like particular event that stands out as like the best gig you've ever done?
I don't know. I couldn't really pinpoint it down specifically. I mean, when I was touring with DJ Yoda, that was quite amazing. I mean, that was my solo stuff. We played like the main stage at festival. I think it was like 15,000 people or something. That was like the biggest in like scale.
How did you get into that? Because that's obviously, I mean, that seems like quite a strange way to get into it with your style of music.
It was with a project that happened at Band on the Wall that most people involved in it, you just like wrote an application to be involved in this project. And then it was like a week long thing where we were doing like live hip hop. And then at the end of it, there was a show, but the show sold out. And then he ended up wanting to make an album out of it because it went really well. So then we ended up touring the album for the following year. So yeah, we were playing in quite prestigious places around the UK. We got to do all the big festivals like Glastonbury, Burntown Fair. No, I've been quite lucky in terms of like I've managed to have an interesting little back catalogue of shows I've played and stuff over the years. But I mean, it's only through persistence. If what you do it has some interest to people, you do end up doing interesting things because people kind of hear it and want you to be involved. There's also dry patches as well, you know, like you've got to be patient.
Is there a particular night that stands out as just an absolute nightmare of an event to do?
Well, there was actually one night, there was another gig at Glastonbury, which I did with some of my friends who were, they do jungle. And they thought it'd be a good idea to have me on with them, like doing some guitar improvising over the jungle set. It was organized so badly. Like the sound guy, he was in a tent in the Unfairground at Glastonbury, and the sound guy had no idea I was going to be there. We'd kind of rehearsed it and it had actually gone well in rehearsal, but then the guy who was DJing he said like after 10 minutes I'll give you your cue and then you come on. And I was just kind of waiting at the sides like dancing, holding my guitar, and then after 10 minutes nothing happened, and then it got to like 20 minutes and nothing had still happened, and I was like, when are you gonna do it? And he was just like, I don't know. And it got to about 45 minutes in, and then it was like I got announced, all the temp went quiet, and then I went to start and there was just no sound coming out of my guitar, so I was just like playing nothing. And it was like a late kind of rave slot as well, so the whole tent just got completely decked out and all worked out. It was awful. It just cleared the tent basically.
That's pretty fast.
yeah it was we've walked off with a sail between the legs really. But there you go, it's just badly organized things will always be worse than a bad performance. Because if the sound isn't right, etc., then it's just going to be awful no matter how well you do.
It does annoy me when like certain promoters or certain events or certain venues are just really, really disorganized and kind of let certain things, try and wing it a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately for me, like my setup is very simple, so I just need like a DI really, and I don't even need a microphone necessarily. I'm almost doing that because of a fear of that kind of technical disorientation. Like I don't know how people who do like all the looping and all the effects, like I wouldn't have the nerve to set up those big foot switch walls on the floor and then expect it all to go okay.
I had a rumor that when Ed Sheeran plays like obviously the massive sets, he gets each individual loop run by a different sound engineer as he goes along. Individually monitored.
He's got the fear that we're talking about then.
He's obviously had some similar gigs. I know he did a lot of the pub scene for a long time before he got famous, to be fair. Yeah. Whether you like his music or not, I know he did his thing.
Yeah, if there's anything that makes me nervous, it's just technical things like that, you know. The idea of just the sound cutting out, or like, you know, if you've got a pedal with a battery in it or something, of just a battery going flat in the middle of the tune, you know, things like that. You can't really you can't really recover from that. Like, you can't style it out. You've got to stop and sort it out, which just kills the illusion for people watching.
I've had that happen loads of times at acoustic gigs in the past. It's one of the reasons why I enjoy doing acoustic gigs, because it's a much easier and quicker setup for me over the band stuff. Yeah. But if you have a disaster and it's just you on your own, it's very, very hard to come back from.
Yeah. But then, I mean, a lot of my stage presence, again, I've kind of developed from that thing of not taking yourself too seriously. It's come from really calamitous gigs where I've like broken loads of strings and stuff and the sound's cut out. And then when that happens, you can't let on that it's upset you. You've got to turn from a musician into a bit of a clown and kind of try and get everyone to see the funny side of it, as opposed to just be like, oh, why did this happen? You've got to turn it into comedy. if it's turning out to be comedy, you've got to just be like, well, this is a comedy show now then.
So in all the time you've been doing gigs, who would you say are the top three unsigned acts or bands that you've ever seen live? So it can be someone that you've played alongside or someone that you've actively gone out and gone to see.
It's interesting. I think one of them is a guy called Shunya, who I was in the group with DJ Yoda with him. He was like a violinist and a bass player. He's like a multi-instrumentalist and he does a lot of like live electronic production, but he's really virtuosic and creates like amazing sort of musical environments. He does live sets with elements of jazz and like electronic music, and yeah, he's just really worth a watch. Another one would be, I'd say Claire Northey is actually a really quite inspiring one to watch. She does amazing things with a violin and a lute pedal, and she's got a lovely voice. It's like a very alt. She's from the Alps, so she's got like sort of an alpine mountain voice, I think.
She's got a really unusual style, and like it's a sound that you don't hear very often.
Yeah, there's kind of like Arabic elements as well to it, like, you know, sort of a few tunes in the Arabic scale, so they've got that kind of like slightly offbeat, like interesting melodic quality. Yeah, she's brilliant. And I suppose there's a guy called John Haycock as well, who's based in Manchester, who does brilliant things with the Cora, and then doing live looping and stuff with the Cora, and he does quite mesmerizing performances as well.
Is looping stuff something that you're really into?
No, I like watching people do it, but I've not got much interest in doing it myself. I think as soon as I start playing guitar, I kind of just lock into that. And I can't imagine sort of handling other aspects of things at the same time, because like it's almost like the point of my performance is that it's all coming out of, like, you know, I'm creating the whole sound organically, and it's all happening before your eyes, as opposed to me kind of sort of building it up from different loops. So yeah, I've found that, you know, the format I play in now is just will continue to keep me occupied forever, I think, because I've got so many ideas that I've not done yet, and I will probably never do everything I want to do.
I think if you played your style of music through a loop pedal as well, it would just become too much. It's already so complicated. It's so complex.
When I'm playing with a band, I've got to sort of tone down what I'm doing quite a lot, because, you know, it's a completely different skill in terms of, but if you're playing in an ensemble, you the whole point is that you've got to kind of fit in, and you've got to be a cog in that machine. So if you overstep the mark and you try and do too much, it just ruins it. I was part of like a jazz group where we do like improvised gigs with Matt and Fred for a while, and that was one of the main things I found, that like it's fine as long as the less everyone's doing, the better it sounds. It's like as soon as everybody starts trying to style it out and get to the bit of the limelight, it just starts clashing. It becomes quite embarrassing. Like it because the sound becomes quite jarring. It just turns into like soup, you know.
Well, that's it. Yeah, there is something to be said for just keeping stuff simple. Even if you know you can do the really complex over the top stuff, you don't have to automatically do it all the time. There are moments in songs where you can bring out your element and then take a seat back while someone else brings out their element or whatever they're bringing to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, someone who's played for Leeds before who does like exceptional looping is Elizabeth Preston. Have you ever seen her live before?
Okay.
She hardly gigs at all anymore, but she used to play for Leeds. She played for Leeds for over about 2.5 years. But she's absolutely stunning. She's got a really, really interesting vocal as well. Kind of Bjorky sounded vocal.
Oh yeah,
she plays cello on a loop pedal, which is really rhythmic.
Oh yeah, I mean it's one of the elite instruments in it. You can't argue with a cello.
I genuinely think you'd really enjoy it, so go and check it out, Elizabeth Preston.
Brilliant. I will be.
At this stage in every episode, I always do three stupid random questions that you haven't seen before and you're not been prepared for. So I'm bringing back an audience favourite for you this week. So what's the weirdest thing you've ever eaten?
Oh, well, I don't know. Let's see. I'm quite into my shellfish and things like that, and I've always had quite a wide range in taste in food. So I don't know. I don't even know what's considered weird. I mean, I eat like octopus and things like that quite regularly, which is
you're the second person I think to say octopus as a weird food.
I don't know if it's the weirdest thing. I think I've eaten rattlesnake once.
Oh wow, that's pretty cool.
It came out of tin as well, which is not how you'd expect it to be served. But yeah.
Yeah, that sounds disgusting.
Tinned rattlesnake. I think I'll stick with that.
What did it actually taste like?
So like. Kind of like, you know, white sort of chickeny, like most things. I mean, you know, all weird meats end up being quite chickeny, like frog's legs and things like that. Just chicken, just kind of got a chicken vibe.
Yeah, when you said tinned, I had like a tuna vibe in my head, but maybe it's more of a chicken texture.
No.
Yeah, the weirdest thing said so far was cat food, which I think is pretty weird, isn't it?
Oh right. No, so yeah, it was supposed to be a kind of gross thing. It was supposed to be a gourmet thing.
No, it doesn't have to
I used
be.
To eat conkers when I was a kid, I think.
Dude, that is pretty weird.
Yeah.
What does a conker taste like?
Intensely bitter, like shoe polish or something.
Oh, that's gross. I suppose they look quite varnished, so that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, question number two. Would you rather have to say every thought that ever pops into your head or never speak again?
I think I probably already do the former. So I would elect to say every thought that comes into my head.
That makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it wouldn't be too far removed from my reality now.
How do you feel when you see people when you're doing it on stage? Do people seem like weirded out sometimes when you say some of the random stuff that comes into your head when you're on stage?
Yeah. I think I kind of blot it out at the time because you know I'm in my own world really. So yeah, I would probably be more concerned if it was in a conversation. But I mean, you know, I don't say anything disturbing.
It's just unusual. But it's always people, like I said before, when people see for the first time, they always think, is he all right, this guy? And then the second time, they get it.
I'm almost making a mockery of the fact that I'm there in the first place. It's like, I don't want to appear to have any grandiosity. So I try and sort of break the ice, you know. I try and burst the bubble of the formality of it all. But yeah, I mean, I've always been someone. I'm one of them people. I can say a lot of words without really meaning anything. You know, I just kind of hide behind hide behind big flowery sentences when if you poke through the fog of what I've said, I've not really said anything at all. I've just said a string of adjectives.
But I think people really want to that because it comes across as you're unintentionally being awkward. But then when you see you a couple of times, you know that that's just what you're trying to do. So yes, it's like certain stand-up comedians who have a persona on stage that they want to present, but they're not really like that in real life.
Yeah, good.
Okay, question number three. Would you rather be able to control any animal apart from humans with your mind or control anything electronic with your mind?
I think the animal one sounds a lot more kind of poetic and a lot more fun, really. If you had like a big flock of seagulls following you everywhere, for example, that would give you some kind of gravitas. They would just all kind of sat behind you, like staring at who you were talking to. Like that person would do what you ask, wouldn't they? So, yeah, I think, you know, nature always wins in the end. So, for the animals.
I figured on the welding side that it would be the electronic thing, but you don't actually use any electronics, do you? It's just flame and heat and metal.
No, you do it in welding, yeah. I mean, no, that would be pretty old school if we were using flames. No, we do. Welders are digital these days, you know.
Like, in my mind, it's still like a flash dance video.
It's so. Like an oxyacetylene torch. But no, I think that was like the Victorian method. I have tried, you know, doing that is a skill of its own. I've tried it a couple of times, but yeah, it's there's a lot of kickback. You get a lot of sort of molten stuff flying in your face and stuff. So it's not advisable to try.
Tell me, you still have to wear those huge face shields though, because that's surely the one reason you're going to wear.
Oh yeah. You've got to look after your eyes. Like I was in hospital about 2 weeks ago getting metal took out my eye again.
Oh yeah, I remember you played a gig actually where you were injured from welding the same day.
Well yeah, if your mask isn't turned up to the right setting, you like burn your eyes basically from looking at the world. So it's like having sunburn on your eyes. So it's really painful, but it's not that bad in terms of it does just go away like sunburn does, but it feels like you're gonna die when it first happens.
Absolutely awful.
yeah, it's not the best, but you know, it's worth it for the rewards of metalwork.
Yeah, you can check out like pictures of your sculptures on your social media, and you're not really one for social media at all, are you, to be honest?
I'm trying to engage as much as I can, but yeah, I mean, I think I always posted about gigs and stuff, but yeah, I think I'm quite old fashioned at heart, so it's I sort of begrudgingly got involved with it eventually, but yeah, I think I was performing for years before I even had a Facebook page or anything. Like it took me a long time to fall in line with all that stuff.
I think you're a rare example of someone who has actually managed to go out and get gigs without having to use social media these days. Every other podcast I've done is place a lot of importance on social media, and I would as well in terms of getting obviously more and more people to listen to your stuff. But you've just gone out there. The old school way of going asking for gigs or being offered gigs and going doing them.
Yeah, I think
it's like the basic way of doing it. It doesn't really exist.
Yeah, I mean, like even the first gigs I got, it was literally like it would be through word of mouth and stuff. So, you know, I always got by okay without that or without doing loads of it. It's definitely, I mean, over the last couple of years where gigs aren't really there, then people who are really good at engaging with people that way, you know, they're thriving now because the traditional way of connecting with people has disappeared recently. So yeah, the way I've done it isn't necessarily the right way at all. I would probably be in a better position if I had put a bit more effort into it.
Do you think that long term is something you're gonna have to focus on more, or are you trying to keep that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm
word,
trying
word
to,
of mouth
I mean,
is the best way to get any gig. If you get recommended to someone, then
I mean, that's you know, really that's what clinches things, you know. I mean, you'll find that most people who are in high positions, it's because of an old-fashioned kind of way that they've gotten there, in terms of it, like, you know, their brother's been the producer of, you know what I mean? Like, it's those old kind of inner circles are still the most powerful gatekeepers in a way.
Yeah, something that comes up every time on this podcast is the importance of networking with people, other bands and other promoters and stuff to gain an edge or gain a step up, really.
Yeah, absolutely. But then, like I say, like, you know, if you do something that people want, then people who want it will ask for it. You know, it's quite simple, but you've just got to be sort of adaptable in where what that might be. I never necessarily wanted to end up doing sort of solo guitar instrumentals. I had all kinds of ideas about where I could end up, but I've ended up doing this for the most part because it's the thing I'm ready to do, and I can have a sort of career doing metalwork, and I can also just then run off in the evening and show up at a gig with my guitar and still do it. Like there's not logistically it works. So that's what I do, you know, because that's what I'm ready to do.
Well, you're in a position where you've got a job that, I don't know, maybe a bit more flexible, but no pun intended.
Yeah, because I'm self-employed, so, like, you know, I'm doing commissions. So as long as the commissions get finished on time, I can still do other things while they're going on, as long as I don't miss the deadline. So, yeah, it's useful in that respect.
So I always ask the same questions when the podcast every single week. What is the number one piece of advice that you would give to a new artist starting out?
Well, I suppose you should really be doing it because you love doing it first and foremost. And you should kind of hold your expectations lightly of what you want to get out of it. Like whatever reward presents itself, then you should be happy that you received that one, you know? Like you shouldn't be too rigid in your idea of where you're going to end up. You should be writing stuff that you think should exist that doesn't exist yet. You know, you shouldn't be doing it because you want. You should be doing it because you want to do it, not because you want to be that person. You know,
that's a really nice way of putting it. Actually, no one's actually said you should be writing stuff that isn't already out there. That's a great way of looking at it. And surely,
yeah, I mean, that's
really the whole purpose of writing original music.
Yeah, because like you should be excited. You should be excited about making something that you think should exist that doesn't exist yet. That's the point of it all.
I think if you come into music with expectations of getting immediate fame or making huge amounts of money in a short period of time, or I don't know,
a lot of people said
the number one thing is to get a girlfriend when they're younger. But if you're coming into it for any of those things, then
you may be disappointed
in the end of the day.
Exactly. Like I said, like I, socially, I didn't really do it for social reasons. I was like a private musician at first. So I was doing it for personal reasons as opposed to it being for me to be in a certain social circle or whatever. But you know, for other people like that, I can completely understand that communal aspect of being in the band and stuff. Because when you are in a band and it's all functioning well, it's lovely. It's a feeling of togetherness. But yeah, I've always been a bit of a loner first and foremost in that respect.
So have you got any upcoming projects? Is there anything we should be looking out for in terms of gigs that you've got planned or any recordings coming out?
I have been gradually building up a new collection of tunes to get out. I mean, I've not sort of officially released anything since like 2016. So I really need to, and despite that, I've been writing and performing new stuff since then. So I really need to get together a new compilation of stuff to put out, which I'm intending on getting out there probably by the end of the year, if not early next year. But yeah, it'll have been a few years in the making, so it will be what, hopefully, a solid body of work.
You're unorthodox not only in terms of like not using social media to promote yourself, but also you don't really do traditional style releases either, or not in recent times. So it'd be good to get bringing an EP out at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's my intention anyway. So yeah, look out for that soon.
So where can we find you on social media if people want to find you?
I'm George Fell Music on Facebook, and it's George_Fell_ on Instagram. And if you search for me on YouTube, you can see a quite varied collection of videos of me performing as well.
Yeah, I fully recommend actually going and watching the videos rather than just listening to recordings, so you can see the actual technique involved in the guitar work, because it is, I said at the start, you genuinely are, in all the years that I've been doing this, in my opinion, the best guitarist that I've ever seen in life.
Wow, that's
and I've been doing this for a long time.
Well, that's very flattering, thank you.
And I realise it is a bold claim for anyone who's listening as well, but if you go and watch the video, you'll see what I mean.
I know, yeah, everyone who plays guitar listening is just going to hate me because you said that now.
Actually, I just remembered a story I was going to mention as well. I've got a friend who was looking at starting up a band. He hadn't done anything live for a long time, and he was a bit nervous about getting into guitar music. And he I said to him, come down to a gig and see George. He's an amazing guitarist. You'll love him. And he came to the gig and he instantly said, what's the point of me joining a band now? Because I'll never be as good as that. So he literally, you destroyed his music career.
My aim is not to discourage. I just want to make people happy. But anyway, yeah.
But he was literally blown away to the point where he feels like he could never bring up the guitar again. So,
well, that's not what I would want. But okay,
it's kind of a compliment. But it's also kind of a compliment. His life, yeah. So. Yeah. Well, so on that bombshell,
an interesting thought to leave me with. Yeah. That poor guy.
yeah. So on that cheery note, we'll leave it there, mate. It's been brilliant talking to you.
Yeah, likewise.
Really nice speaking to you, mate. Well, I'll speak to you again soon. Cheers. Bye.
See you also.
So that was George Fell. Really appreciate him coming on. Hopefully you enjoyed that one, guys. Don't forget, you can follow us at Leaf Promotions on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. Give us a like and subscribe wherever you listen to this podcast. It really helps us out. Hopefully it won't be as long before we get the next episode done. We'll let you know well in advance. Catch you next time. Bye.